Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with more evidence that the wrong people are on trial for the Iraq War and that Paul Wolfowitz, not Bradley Manning, should be in the dock. A 17-year veteran of the CIA, Phil Giraldi, joins us to discuss the latest scandal he has uncovered about how the neocons were conned and Iran played Uncle Sam for Uncle Sucker. Phil Giraldi's latest article at the American Conservative is Paul Wolfowitz's Iran Connection: Was the Architect of the Iraq War Getting Advice from an Agent of the Islamic Republic? Then, with the president's announcement today that he is appointing Susan Rice to be his next national security advisor and that she will be replaced as U.S. ambassador to the UN by Samantha Power, we will speak with David Rothkopf, the CEO and editor-at-large of Foreign Policy magazine and author of Running the World, the Inside Story of the National Security Council and the Architects of American Power. We'll discuss Obama's defiance of his Republican critics who have trumped up charges against Susan Rice over the phony Benghazi scandal and assess what changes she will bring to U.S. foreign policy. Then finally, an important member of the Syrian opposition, Radwan Ziyadeh, joins us to discuss the loss of a key strategic town to Hezbollah and what that means for the Free Syrian Army in their long struggle to defeat the Assad regime, whose fight for survival appears to be improving as the tide of battle turns in their favor. We will also discuss the difference between Assad's backers, Russia, Iran, and Hezbollah, and the lack of support the outgunned rebels are getting from the U.S. and the EU. And joining us now is Philip Giraldi, who for 17 years was a CIA operations officer specializing in counterterrorism throughout Europe and the Middle East. He now works in the private sector doing security consulting and writes a column in the American Conservative on international security issues. His latest article at the American Conservative is Paul Wolfowitz's Iran Connection: Was the Architect of the Iraq War Getting Advice from an Agent of the Islamic Republic? Welcome to Background Briefing, Phil Giraldi.
Well, thank you for having me on again.
And this latest news from you, Phil, comes on top of what has been probably one of the greatest penetrations of American foreign policy and intelligence at the highest level by Ahmad Chalabi, who was the darling of the neocons and in many ways, along with Wolfowitz and company, was the architect of the Iraq War in terms of beguiling the American side into believing that Chalabi would be the kind of Nelson Mandela of the new Iraq after Saddam was toppled. And turned out all along, Chalabi was working with the Iranians, and apparently the National Security Agency finally told George W. Bush, the president, that Chalabi had told the Iranians that the NSA had broken Iran's diplomatic code. And Bush was so furious that he ordered the Pentagon to cut all ties. And even then, the Pentagon, under Doug Feith, slow-walked Bush's orders and made him even more furious. So there's a whole story there, is there not?
Yeah, there is. I mean, obviously, there was a lot of finagling going on in the lead-up to the Iraq War, but Chalabi has to win the prize as the ultimate finagler, I think. He essentially was producing intelligence that was completely fraudulent about the capabilities of Saddam Hussein's Iraq, because obviously the key to this was to pretend that there was some kind of threat emanating from Iraq against the United States. And at the same time, he clearly was playing every side. He no doubt had his own constituencies inside Iraq. He was hoping to become either prime minister or president of the country. And he was also colluding with the Iranians. He was passing not only assessments to, like the one you cited, showing that we had been breaking their diplomatic code, but he also was passing hard intelligence, actual reports, which his contacts in the Pentagon were giving to him. So the whole story is quite incredible.
Well, of course, you know, he has not, I guess he's beyond the grasp of American law, but Wolfowitz and Feith and company have never been put on trial, have they? I mean, that we've got Bradley Manning on trial now, but the real architects of this catastrophe have not only gone free, they still are listened to by the press. And in many ways, the usual suspects who brought us the Iraq disaster are now trying to get us into a war with Syria.
Yeah, it's exactly the same players. Wolfowitz is at the now at the American Enterprise Institute, where he has a senior position. That's after he lost his job at the World Bank as president through some indiscretions. And yeah, these guys never go away. That's part of the problem. But the legal issue is that you would have to prove that they actually knew what they were doing when they possibly colluded at starting a war. That's a little bit hard to prove. And we can cite a lot of examples of where they were pushing intelligence through the system, but they would claim if they were in a courtroom that they believed this stuff to be true.
Well, as you probably know, Phil, I was following up on the story of who forged the Niger documents, which I think is key to the whole story about Joe Wilson and Valerie Plame. And curiously enough, that was never really pushed by the mainstream press. It seemed to me to be really germane to the whole idea of one of the main pieces of evidence that, or alleged evidence that got us into the Iraq War, was this idea that Saddam was trying to buy uranium from Niger. And in an interview with a former senior CIA officer who mentioned that the documents were forged over here, I suggested that perhaps Michael Ledeen, who had been involved with Italian intelligence, I believe, forging documents to incriminate Jimmy Carter's brother, might have had a hand in this. And Ledeen came after me immediately. So to my mind, when you say you couldn't put him on trial because of essentially they could be guilty of stupidity but not mendacity, surely forging documents to get us into a war is mendacity.
Well, it surely is, and certainly in the case of the Niger documents, there's no question about that. But the ultimate question becomes who forged them. Like Wolfowitz will always claim, or Feith will claim, that the documents that were given them by Chalabi, they accepted in good faith and believed that they were accurate. And obviously, if any of them were tried for the Niger forgeries, it would be the same argument. You'd have to actually get the guy who did the forgery and get him to appear in court and say, you know, I did it, and then I passed it to so-and-so, and they knew they were fake. But, of course, that's a tough hurdle to get over.
Again, I'm speaking with Phil Giraldi, who for 17 years was a CIA operations officer specializing in counterterrorism throughout Europe and the Middle East. He now works in the private sector doing security consulting and writes a column in the American Conservative on international security issues. His latest article at the American Conservative is Paul Wolfowitz's Iran Connection: Was the Architect of the Iraq War Getting Advice from an Agent of the Islamic Republic? Let's now talk about that. I just brought up Chalabi because that was bad enough. But now you're bringing to the table this other aspect of how the neocons got conned. And in this case, this Iraqi doctor who organized a group of Iraqis that Paul Wolfowitz met with regularly in late 2002 and early 2003, he met secretly with this group of Iraqi expatriates led by this doctor. So take us from there, the extraordinary story of Dr. Ali Al-Attar.
Yeah, well, it appears that Wolfowitz decided that he needed his own independent sources of information on what was going on inside Iraq. So he, through means that I don't know exactly how he got in touch with these people, but he wound up getting in touch with a group headed by one Dr. Ali Al-Attar, who was practicing medicine in Virginia and Maryland at the time. And Wolfowitz would meet with Al-Attar and a number of other Iraqi expats, and he would get their assessments on the situation in Iraq, and they basically gave him information that suggested that the American troops would be greeted with shouts of joy, with flowers, you know, the usual sorts of arguments. And Wolfowitz apparently was somewhat taken in by this. When it didn't turn out that way, Wolfowitz called this group in again and very angrily confronted them and said, why were you wrong? He wasn't wrong, of course, but why were you wrong? And they told him basically that they didn't know, but that the Americans had behaved very brutally upon arrival in Iraq and had alienated a lot of public opinion. So that's the story, but the backstory is the interesting part. This Iraqi doctor, it turns out, was simultaneously engaged in all kinds of fraud. He was being investigated by the IRS. He was being investigated by the FBI. He was he was kicked out of the medical profession by the authorities in Maryland. And it appears that Wolfowitz didn't know any of this. The guy fled the country, fled the United States when he was about to be arrested, wound up in Beirut, and it turns out that there's yet another story there. This guy was seen on the street in Beirut with Hezbollah people, and furthermore, the guy himself, though born in Iraq, is an Iranian. He's born of an Iranian mother and father. So it throws an interesting wrinkle into what might have been happening and who might have been conning whom in the lead-up to the Iraq War.
So if you combine the story of Dr. Ali Al-Attar, who it appears was an Iranian agent all along, and Ahmad Chalabi, who appears that he was an Iranian agent all along, Phil Giraldi, then you have to ask yourself, what were the Iranians doing in manipulating the United States? Did they want them, basically? Is Uncle Sam, Uncle Sucker here, that the Iranians wanted us to come in there, knock off Saddam Hussein, and then know that we would just open up a hornet's nest and eventually get driven out of there, and they'd end up owning the country, which is the current situation?
Yeah, that's basically the current situation. I don't know if they were looking that far ahead, but certainly Saddam Hussein was their enemy, and he had a very relative to the region he was in, a relatively strong military force, still quite capable of confronting a country like Iran. And so it was completely in the Iranian interest to have the United States go in there and destroy this guy, with the expectation that the result of that would be a government that would be dominated by the Shia majority in Iran, which would inevitably be a lot friendlier towards Iran.
So from your understanding about all the pre-Iraq war intelligence and how much it was stovepiped and cooked by the neocons, have you ever come across any evidence of anybody telling, and George Bush apparently met regularly in the White House with the kind of people that we're talking about, and he was regularly briefed by these experts, so-called experts from the American Enterprise Institute and other neoconservative think tanks. My understanding of government, and particularly the National Security Council, is on pretty much every National Security Council, including even the Reagan administration, which was often accused of being too ideological, there were dissenting voices that they allowed for a broad array of input and didn't just rely on a small cadre of like-minded people. So have you ever found any evidence that there was anybody inside that government that ever said, wait a minute, this is a bad idea?
Yeah. Well, the only evidence of that would have to be the few State Department officers that resigned in protest to the development of the argument for the war with Iraq. I think it is correct to say at the time of the Bush administration, there was no institutional pushback. There was no capability of anybody arguing against whatever had been decided to be the policy line. So that's what we saw. And plus, Bush was, you know, he was basically, it was clear, I know from my time at CIA when all this was going on, it was clear that Cheney and Bush wanted certain types of information that basically implicated Iran and created Iraq and created a casus belli, a reason for war. And it was clear that that's what they were wanted. So that went all the way down the pipeline, and everybody who cared about their jobs had to be aware of that. And also, of course, they were getting this this nonsense from groups like the American Enterprise Institute, which would send its experts over, and they would brief them. They'd say the same thing. So all they were hearing was basically that Iraq was, for any number of reasons, a threat against the United States and had to be dealt with.
But how do you explain the actions of the director of Central Intelligence, George Tenet? He is supposed to be the number one intelligence officer in the country. And he, as we know, had Colin Powell and Colonel Wilkerson outside in the conference room on the seventh floor there for a couple of days going over all of the intelligence ahead of Powell's famous speech at the United Nations, which became the kind of final nail in the coffin, if it will, of the U.S.'s determination to go to war, and then he made the case in front of the world that turned out to be almost entirely bogus. There were some people in the agency that I've spoken to, like Tyler Drumheller and others, who kept saying, you know, this guy Curveball, this fellow that the Germans have, is completely unreliable, and all of his intelligence, which Powell presented to the UN, was bogus. So what explains, why did Tenet sell the war and effectively hung Powell out to dry? And to this day, Powell and Wilkerson regret what they did.
Well, Powell knew that he was lying. I don't know what the story is on Tenet, to be honest. I suspect Tenet was just an extremely ambitious guy who knew what the White House wanted and was willing to provide the intelligence to say that. I suspect that's what it is. Tenet, as far as I'm concerned, had no moral integrity whatsoever in this whole lead-up to the war. He was basically a yes man for Dick Cheney, essentially, in the White House. So, I don't know what was going through Tenet's head, but there certainly were a lot of people at CIA. I used to hear them myself and talk to them myself, who said, you know, there's no real intelligence suggesting that Iraq is in any way a threat to the United States. I heard a lot of that in 2002. And basically, everybody kind of knew it. And Colin Powell, after going through the intelligence, knew it. But everybody was a good team player on this, and they gave George Bush what he wanted.
Well, as far as I know, on the record, the only person who ever spoke out against this monstrous folly was the former National Security Advisor under Bush Sr., Brent Scowcroft, who wrote an op-ed, and then he got pretty much frozen out. And it leads you to ask the question, is, you know, presumably Bush's own father, who's close to Scowcroft, shared Scowcroft's skepticism about this misadventure. Yet he did not, the father never told the son about his presumable qualms about what the son was doing.
Well, apparently the son never spoke to the father about it. I think that's a more accurate version, that he should have talked to his father, but he didn't. He ruled that out, and he refused to talk to his father in the lead up to the war. I think the elder Bush had a whole lot more sense than the younger Bush, and he certainly might have been able to influence the argument, but there was no argument because Bush Jr. wouldn't talk to him.
And on the other side, in terms of our loyal opposition in this so-called democracy that we have, Phil Giraldi, you know, I've spoken to Senator Bob Graham, who was chair of the Intelligence Committee at the time, and he told me that the White House was going to go ahead and invade Iraq without an NIE, without a national intelligence estimate, and that Senator Graham and the Intelligence Committee insisted on one being provided, and even the one that was provided that was doctored by the neocons in the Pentagon was, if you actually read the damn thing, it made it pretty clear that there wasn't a case for war. And it's interesting that almost all of the senators on the Intelligence Committee, with the exception of Dianne Feinstein and John Edwards, voted against the war. And yet prominent Democrats like Hillary Clinton and John Kerry, who presumably had the same information, voted for it. So our loyal opposition clearly failed us. Not only that, of course, the press failed us too by getting on the war bandwagon.
Yeah, well, I've spoken to congressmen subsequently after the war was started and was going badly, and they were kind of coming to me and saying, well, why is this happening? And I said, well, you know, everyone in the intelligence agencies knew this was essentially a fake. And the congressman would say to me, yeah, but we didn't know that. I think there were a lot of people who were very poorly informed in the lead up to the war. Congressmen aren't necessarily any smarter than the rest of us. In fact, they may go the other way. But the fact is that they seem to have been, as a group, very, very poorly informed. They would be given briefings by the White House or briefings by committee members and things like that. But in general, they really didn't know a whole lot about what was going on. And they basically bought into the argument that that was being propagated by the administration, which is that there was an existential threat against the United States and it had to be dealt with.
Well, just in closing, Phil Giraldi, since you've brought us this new information in American Conservative, Paul Wolfowitz's Iran connection, was the architect of the Iraq War, getting advice from an agent of the Islamic Republic. Again, the uber neocon got conned, and the country, as I mentioned, Uncle Sam ends up as Uncle Sucker here. And the Iranians win the Iraq war, and China wins the oil, which is what we just learned recently from page story in the New York Times. What is our takeaway? What are you hoping that the public learns from your article revealing yet another reason for the disaster?
Well, the bigger story is that these guys in Washington don't necessarily know anything more than we do. They make bad decisions. They essentially get wrong information and choose to believe it for one reason or another. And we should bear this in mind as we look ahead. And people should be thinking this very sort of thing as they think about the possibility of intervention in Syria or the possibility of a war down the road with Iran. They should begin to question what they're being fed and ask, you know, what is the real source of this kind of information? How reliable is it? Is there any possibility that somebody is feeding us something that they want us to believe? And I think the example of the Iraq war should be a lesson to all of us.
Well, Phil Giraldi, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
All right, thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Phil Giraldi, who for 17 years was a CIA operations officer specializing in counterterrorism throughout Europe and the Middle East. He now works in the private sector doing security consulting and writes a column in the American Conservative on international security issues. His latest article at the American Conservative is Paul Wolfowitz's Iran Connection, Was the Architect of the Iraq War Getting Advice from an Agent of the Islamic Republic? We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the president's announcement today that Susan Rice will be the next national security advisor and Samantha Power will be the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Rothkopf, who's the CEO and editor-at-large of Foreign Policy magazine. He's also president and CEO of Garton Rothkopf and a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and the author of Running the World, The Inside Story of the National Security Council and the Architects of American Power and Superclass, The Global Elite and the World They Are Making. His latest book is Power Incorporated, The Epic Rivalry Between Big Business and Government and the Reckoning That Lies Ahead. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Rothkopf.
It's good to be back.
And today, the president in the Rose Garden made some fairly monumental announcements that are bound to irritate the Republican chair of the House committee that is trying to investigate the White House at every turn, Darrell Issa, in as much as the president has appointed Susan Rice to be the next national security advisor when Tom Donilon steps down soon. So, and of course, Samantha Power is going to take Susan Rice's position at the United Nations. What's your response to this, particularly in the context of this trench warfare that's going on between the Republicans, McCain and Issa, in terms of blaming Susan Rice for this trumped-up Benghazi story?
Look, I think the president's handling of this was a sign of confidence, and I think it was also rising above the din of this Washington food fight that's going on. You know, if anybody's irritated by it, it's people who have made the issue into an irritant themselves. Nobody since Benghazi has asserted at any point or demonstrated in any way that Susan Rice did anything other than what any public official would do, which is take the talking points they were given and present them via the media outlets she was asked to present them on. If there was mishandling of, you know, security in Benghazi, she had nothing to do with that. If there was mishandling of, or the framing of the talking points, she also didn't have anything to do with that. So, I think it's an issue only to those who wish to make it an issue. But, you know, Washington being what it was, the president knew that some of these people are going to go and howl. And I think he said, go ahead, howl. I'm going to pick the best people. I'm going to pick the team that I'm comfortable with. And I just can't, you know, let U.S. national security be held hostage to petty politics.
Well, it would seem, though, that Susan Rice is just a surrogate for their relentless attack on the president himself. And she is quite close to the president, is she not?
Susan Rice is kind of the original passenger on the Obama national security train, right? She was the first person that he had on his national security team. She was the person he asked to put together the national security team during the campaign. She was the person who oversaw the national security transition between the campaign going into office. She has always been close to him. She is close to the people who are close to him. He has faith in her. And I think, frankly, given the Benghazi thing, one of the things that he's doing is he's sending a loud and clear message, which is, you can take shots at her, but she is my woman for this job, and I am going to stand by her. And, I am committed and loyal to the people who are close to me. That's going to give her a lot of advantages in dealing with people around the world, because they're going to say, I know this woman has the full confidence of the president.
So how has, David Rothkopf, since you've written about the National Security Council in Running the World, the inside story of the National Security Council and the architects of American power, has the president been on a kind of learning curve here in terms of his National Security Council? It seemed like the initial choice of a Marine general was a bit of a misstep.
I think early on the president was trying to put together a team. Sometimes when you put together a team, there's chemistry. Sometimes there's not chemistry. I think General Jones didn't fit in the team, but he made perfect sense as a choice, as one of the most distinguished military leaders of his time. And it wasn't a fiasco; it just didn't work out. Tom Donilon, who had been Jones's deputy, stepped in. They put together a good, solid national security process. Donilon did an excellent job in maintaining the process, but also the confidence of other people in the cabinet that he would be an honest broker. And on some issues like China, issues, relations with the Gulf, relations with Israel, relations with Russia, he played an active role traveling the world and doing important missions. I think they've got the NSC working pretty well, and I think one of the challenges for Rice is going to be to keep it working well.
Again, I'm speaking with David Rothkopf, who is CEO and editor-at-large at Foreign Policy Magazine. He's also the president and CEO of Garton Rothkopf and a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and the author of Running the World, The Inside Story of the National Security Council and the Architects of American Power and Superclass, the Global Elite and the World They Are Making. His latest book is Power, Inc., The Epic Rivalry Between Big Business and Government and the Reckoning That Lies Ahead. So with Susan Rice's appointment, I guess, and its promotion in the sense that the National Security Advisor is an extremely important post, somebody that spends an awful lot of time up close and personal with the president, and then Samantha Power assuming Susan Rice's position as a U.S. ambassador to the U.N., you have two women in high places in this administration, both of whom in many ways have their political genesis, if you will, in a recognition of human rights and the importance of combating genocide. Apparently, when Susan Rice was in the Clinton White House, she's still haunted in many ways by what happened in Rwanda and the failure to intervene and prevent that genocide. And both she and Samantha Power apparently weighed in on the president, along with Hillary Clinton, to get involved in Libya. So how is this going to translate then in terms of the U.S., for example, dealing with what's happening in Syria and other places around the world where we have, well, let's look at the Congo. I mean, millions have died there and there hasn't been an intervention there. So do you think that this means more humanitarian intervention in the future?
I doubt it. I think that the United States will follow roughly the same approach that it's followed thus far, taking things on a case-by-case basis and intervening both where we have to and where we can make a difference. The difference between Libya and Syria is the issue of whether we could actually step in and get something done in a fairly contained cost way in a fairly defined period of time that would actually materially advance our interests. I think it, right now it's still unclear whether that can happen in Syria. I think Susan may lean in on these issues a little bit more than Tom Donilon did. I think Samantha Power may lean in a little bit more on these issues, and I think that you're likely to get you know, more active consideration on some of these fronts. But the United States still faces fundamental constraints, both in terms of, you know, our resources and how actively we can be involved in multiple problems, and in terms of political will of the American people to put our soldiers at risk in lots of places around the world, particularly after the debacles in Iraq and Afghanistan.
But when you, if you place a value on morality, if you will, in foreign policy and intervening on the basis of human rights, particularly in the face of genocide, how can you ignore what's happening in Syria, where you've just had this reversal of this key strategic town falling to Hezbollah and the Assads, and apparently a lot of Free Syrian Army soldiers were killed and a number of them surrendered, and you know, one doubts their fate, frankly, given the brutality of this war.
Well, I mean, look, you know, if you're asking me whether I think the United States can have or should have done more in Syria, whether we should have intervened earlier, established humanitarian corridors, discussed the establishment of no-fly zone, worked with other countries to establish that, contained the problem within Syria, I think all of those things make some sense. I think the problems in Syria have to do with the fact that among the opposition, you've got a lot of bad actors, and we're unclear who's really in the leadership. I think it's also a situation where once you resolve the Assad problem, you're still left with the Shiite, Sunni, Alawite divisions within the country, and I think that Syria is going to be a volatile place for a long, long time to come. I think the United States should intervene in those places in the world where we can make a difference. I think we should avoid getting bogged down in those places where we can't. That's been the hard riddle of Syria. I do think that what worries me the most about Syria is that the problems can spill into other places like Jordan, like Lebanon, like Israel, like Iraq. And you're seeing, I think, a smart response on the administration. It's a little slower than I would have liked, and it's a little less than I would have liked. But, for example, we're sending military supplies to Jordan now to help them contain this. I think if the conclusion is that Syria is likely to be a volatile place for the next 5 to 10 years, then our goal shouldn't be, you know, just let's try to stabilize the unstabilizable. It should be, how do we contain this so that it doesn't produce worse problems beyond the borders?
But it does seem that the Russians know what they want, and they're acting fairly resolutely, and the Iranians certainly know what they want, and they've been doubling down, and Hezbollah has clearly, essentially, put boots on the ground and may well be the reason why the tide of battle is turning. So in the face of the opposition that seems to really know what they want, it seems that the United States and Europe, their problem is that they know what they don't want, but they don't seem to know what they want. Isn't there an obvious contrast there between the determination?
Sure, because the Iranians and the Russians and Hezbollah, and let's be clear, Hezbollah and the Iranians are the same thing, want Assad to stay in power. They placed a bet on it, and they're gonna stick with their bet. They've got their guy. We don't have our guy, or we don't have our group. We're trying to sort that out actively. I think that there is an effort to do that. But again, our job is not to resolve the problems of Syria. Our job is to advance the national interests of the United States of America, and that means, you know, in that part of the world, to enhance stability, to ensure access to resources, to ensure that political problems in one place don't become political problems in places that are problems for us, and wherever possible to do what we can to ensure that the values and international laws that we're seeking to advance are advanced. Sometimes you can't do all those things. I think we have been too slow to intervene. I think we've been too slow to act. But having said that, I think it's completely understandable why we have been too slow for choices in Syria.
Well, Senator McCain doesn't seem to feel in any way restrained in offering advice here. He seems to have pretty clear ideas what should be done. And he just on Sunday, on the Sunday talk shows, he talked about bombing Syria's airstrips with cruise missiles, etc. How do you think he's going to work with Susan Rice? He's already...
I think he's going to try to work with Susan Rice. You know, John McCain, for all of his occasionally over-the-top statements and, you know, some short temper sometimes, has been somebody who's historically been able to work across the aisle on a lot of these issues and who takes the issues seriously. And I think, you know, some of what John McCain says are things that Susan Rice and President Obama may well be a little bit sympathetic to. Having said that, Senator McCain's a senator. And it's his job to offer up his opinion and to try to mobilize, you know, processes in the Senate in ways that support them. But it's the president's job to ultimately determine whether or not to put U.S. soldiers in harm's way. And I think those are very, very different jobs. And that's why the president's a little bit slower to act than the senator.
And in terms of Samantha Power going to the U.N., given her history of having written about genocide in the Balkans and around the world in her book, The Problem from Hell, do you think that she's going to bring something new to the UN, given that there, I mentioned, for example, the ongoing Holocaust, if you will, in the Congo, where millions have died and the international response has been, well, not particularly useful, shall we say?
Look, I hope she does. Problem from Hell is one of the great books that I've ever read on any foreign policy subject ever. I think she nailed it, and frankly, you know, I think, you know, if you go back and read the book, Susan Rice and some of her colleagues in the Clinton administration couldn't have been too comfortable with the assessment of what happened in Rwanda that Samantha Power had offered up in the book. You know, the UN ambassador has limited ability to mobilize things. And the reason that we don't intervene and we don't have solutions in places like Congo is that it really requires a multilateral effort where multiple powers that have the ability to project force are willing to work together to do so. And it's very rare that that happens. It is a deep flaw. It is a profound human failing that we can get through the 20th century with genocides in Armenia and genocides in Hitler's Europe and genocides in Mao's China and genocides in Stalin's Russia and genocide in Congo and Cambodia and Timor, and the list goes on, and still not have said, this is a problem the world needs to work together to resolve. We need a kind of an interventive force that works at the UN level on behalf of multiple countries to go in and do this. We need real sanctions against governments that do this, that have teeth. We need to put people away who do these kind of things and swift enforcement of those laws. We need to treat genocide like, you know, it's a threat to all of us, because it is a threat to all of us. We haven't done it. She may raise the consciousness on this, I think one has to look at recent history and be a little bit skeptical, even if that's depressing.
Well, David Rothkopf, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks.
Again, I've been speaking with David Rothkopf, who is CEO and editor-at-large of Foreign Policy Magazine. He's also president and CEO of Garton Rothkopf and a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and the author of Running the World, The Inside Story of the National Security Council and the Architects of American Power, and Superclass, the Global Elite and the World They Are Making. And his latest book is Power, Inc., The Epic Rivalry Between Big Business and Government and the Reckoning That Lies Ahead. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with an important member of the Syrian opposition about the Free Syrian Army's loss of a key strategic town. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Radwan Ziadeh, who's the founder and director of the Damascus Center for Human Rights Studies. He's also a visiting scholar at the Carr Center for Human Rights at Harvard University and a visiting fellow at Chatham House, the Royal Institute of International Affairs in London. He also co-founded and directed the Syrian Center for Political and Strategic Studies in Washington, D.C., and previously he was the editor-in-chief of Tiriyat magazine and secretary of the Syrian Organization for Transparency. Welcome to Background Briefing, Radwan Ziadeh.
Thank you for having me.
And the Syrian army and the Assad regime are claiming victory and that they have retaken the town, the strategically important town of Qusair, which is on the Lebanese border. How much of this is a setback for the Syrian rebels and the Free Syrian Army, who apparently they've lost a number of rebels have died and others have surrendered? And, of course, if you surrender to Hezbollah or the Assads, I think your fate is very much in question.
I think this is a message not only for the Syrian opposition, but also to the friends of Syria, and above all of that, to the United States, because this is a victory not for the Assad regime. The Assad regime has lack of human sources, but a big victory for Hezbollah. The ability for Hezbollah to involve and to play a key role in the city and to be able to retake the city, Qusair, inside Syria shows that the Hezbollah commitment to fight the Syrian people and to be backing, not only backing, but also to fight instead of the Assad militia and mafia. This is why, you know, the message for the international community and for the United States, if they want to be silent, then will be a much more for the Hezbollah, not only in the border city, in the city of Qusair, maybe in other cities. Otherwise, Hezbollah will take a role in Aleppo, in Damascus, and other areas. And if Hezbollah now declare a victory in Al-Qusair, maybe in the coming days, Hezbollah will declare a victory in other areas.
Well, apparently, the Free Syrian Army have been starved of weapons, despite the fact that the European Union have decided to lift the embargo on arms to the Syrian rebels. So how much is the fact that the Free Syrian Army appears to be outgunned a factor in this?
This is actually the main reason that the Free Syrian Army, they have the courage, they have the belief to defend their own city and on Qusair, and to defend the civilians that are living in Al-Qusair. But they are heavy, heavy shillings, and the Assad regime is to use the helicopters, the fighter jets from the sky, and the Hezbollah fighters on the ground. And this is why when they lack of guns, lack of ammunition, they have nothing to do. This is a message that the United States and the Arabian Union, they have to understand and to step in to support the Free Syrian Army. Otherwise, the calculation of the Assad, it's now changed in its own side, where President Obama said that we have to change the calculation of Assad. But I think the calculation can change to be on the Assad side rather than the opposition side.
So what happened to the EU's promise of arms to the Free Syrian Army?
Let's keep promising. Give us promises. Nothing real in hand. There is no actually such real support on the ground for the Free Syrian Army. They keep giving us promises, but there is no such clear support on the ground. And that makes the situation quite difficult.
Again, I'm speaking with Radwan Ziadeh, who's the founder and director of the Damascus Center for Human Rights Studies. He's also a visiting scholar at the Carr Center for Human Rights at Harvard University and a visiting fellow at Chatham House, the Royal Institute of International Affairs in London. He also co-founded and directed the Syrian Center for Political Strategic Studies in Washington, D.C., and previously was the editor-in-chief of Tiriat magazine and secretary of the Syrian Organization for Transparency. So what about threats now from the Free Syrian Army to carry the battle into Lebanon against Hezbollah, now that Hezbollah, according to what you just told us, Radwan Ziadeh, is really the reason why this town fell? Is Hezbollah vulnerable to attacks on other fronts?
It's now no more indication. Now Hezbollah, it's a full-scale involvement on the Syrian fight, and this is why the Free Syrian Army, they have no reason to actually to fight, even that inside Lebanon. We already, the Syrian conflict spilled over to Lebanon, and the Hezbollah role of that gives a justification for the Free Syrian Army to shell Hezbollah areas inside Lebanon. It will be a long fight. At the same time that Lebanon will be the price of what Hezbollah did inside Syria.
So will this reignite the civil war in Lebanon?
It's a high chance and high probability for Lebanon to break again in a civil war, because you have Hezbollah from one side, and you have the Salafi group, the Palestinian, from the other side, which actually they are supporting the Syrian people. They are no longer will accept to be silent. And this is why most probably it's easy to get the guns, and the fight will start in Lebanon. It's Lebanon will break down in a civil war again.
So what explains this reversal of fortune for the Assad regime? Many times the Turkish leadership, the American Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, the White House, over the last couple of years have said that Assad would fail, he would collapse, he would be finished eventually. But it looks as though not only has the Assad regime held on, they seem to be gaining ground. So what explains?
We are very cautious of such comments coming from Secretary Clinton and the Secretary Kerry about that, because this is statements irrelevant to what's going on the ground. If there is no support to the rebels, if there is no support to the Free Syrian Army, the Assad has no problem to revoke Hezbollah or Iranian fighters. We have a crazy leadership. It doesn't even accept to step aside to save Syria, but even that has no problem actually to provoke a civil war in the whole region. It's now not only in Lebanon, but also in Iraq. I think that the international community, they have to understand how the Assad is dangerous is. And this is, they should act according to that. If they give the Assad more days, that means the whole region will be in danger.
But what we understand that the Russians are determined to support Assad, the Iranians are determined to support Assad, and Hezbollah is already sending its armies in to support Assad. What is your understanding as an important member of the Syrian opposition? What is your understanding why the West and the Europeans and the Americans and the Turks are not matching what the Russians and the Iranians are doing?
I think that what the administration said, that they don't need quick victory for the opposition in Syria. But they don't, they have very short-minded vision. They don't know exactly the dynamics in, within the region. And this is why when they wait, they don't know strategically how things will go, will goes on. And this is exactly where the things in Syria is going to the full-scale civil war, not only in Syria, but in the whole region. This is something that the administration here, they don't understand. Even though they don't understand, they don't care because they don't see an immediate threat to their strategic interest. But in the long run, of course, there is a huge threat to the U.S. National security issues and priorities.
So in other words, what you're telling us, Radwan Ziadeh, is that the Obama administration sees this as an ongoing struggle between the Free Syrian Army and the Assad regime, and you're saying that already the conflict is spreading into Lebanon and Iraq, and that they just don't get it, that this is already becoming a regional war?
Because for them, actually, they don't see any kind of involvement. They see if we need to involve, then it will be for the U.S. to fail to do anything or to help. Because as Senator Kerry, Secretary Kerry said, we are too late to do anything to save Syria. And I think this is the case. If we've been pushing this administration to do more and more from the beginning, there is a clear indication from the beginning how things is going. But this administration doesn't want to do anything useful.
So what are you, as a member of the opposition and the Free Syrian Army and this coalition of fighters that it has, what are you going to do? I mean, what's your strategy now that you must feel completely abandoned?
We have other options. We have to continue fight. We have to continue struggle. And we have to rely only on our allies, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and other Arabic countries. We hope that the EU, France, UK can do more when they lift now the arms embargo. And we hope also the US, if they can move quickly, not just give statements and promises, which they cannot fulfill all these promises anymore.
Well, do you think the fact that the French President François Hollande said today that there is mounting proof of chemical weapons use in Syria and this obliges the international community to act within the framework of international law, what is he suggesting to your mind?
How many times have we heard such kind of statements? I think the people who are working on the media, they already know that's been repeated for quite a number of times. But nothing come up with it. This is why we are very cautious to take this statement seriously if there is no action.
And what about these peace talks that Russia and the United States are trying to...
It's a blah, blah peace talks, and everyone knows that. If the Assad is serious, why they actually launched this huge attack, not only in Qusair, in other areas, in Damascus suburbs. Everyone knows that there is no political solution on the table right now, and everything has to be come through with a calculation on the ground. Otherwise, I don't see that this peace talks has any promising ending to the Syrian conflict.
So when this struggle began over 2 years ago, it seemed to be fairly clear that I think about up to 80% of the country was opposed to the Assads and 20% are in favor. And just even spite of the fact that the Assads control the military and the Muhabarat, the secret police, the assumption is that the majority would eventually prevail. So is this really a case where the Russians, the Iranians, and Hezbollah have really changed this calculus? And how much do you feel, as a member of the Syrian opposition, that your majority of the population in the country that you represent are going to continue the fight?
Exactly. This is the case, and this is the description. Because the Assad actually uses the state sources, the army and the security, and this is just to kill whatever, or to destroy this 80% of the population. And the international community allow him to do that with the support now. Now it's an obvious that in the last 6 months he has lack of human sources. Now that he get it from Iran and Hezbollah. Does the international community of the United States, they should allow that to happen? Actually, this is the question of the Obama administration, and this is the question of the West also to see if they allow that to continue, or they should step in, take actions, and end the Syrian conflict and Ukraine.
But what you're telling us is that the Assads will just keep killing until they kill all of their opposition? Is that their strategy?
I don't see any other strategy, and it's a clear strategy, and for him it's working. Because he's gaining actually what he lost in the last two years, and this is for him. He doesn't care if the Qusair, it's clear because they have some very strong resolution from the UN Human Rights Council, very strong statements, but he doesn't care.
Well, Radwan Ziadeh, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Radwan Ziadeh, who is the founder and director of the Damascus Center for Human Rights Studies. He's also a visiting scholar at the Carr Center for Human Rights at Harvard University and a visiting fellow at Chatham House, the Royal Institute for International Affairs in London. He also founded and directed the Syrian Center for Political and Strategic Studies in Washington, D.C., and previously was the editor-in-chief of Tiriat magazine and secretary of the Syrian Organization for Transparency. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.